All right, you're tuned in to the Critical Mass Radio Network. This is Enemy Combatant Radio in San Francisco. Critical Mass Radio airs the last Friday of every month, broadcasting nationwide on web radio and pirate radio stations in San Diego, Los Angeles, Santa Cruz, San Francisco, Portland, and New York City. This is our Halloween election special, so we have a number of interviews lined up for you this evening. Definitely stay tuned. It should be interesting. We'll also have people calling in from Critical Mass here in San Francisco. The Halloween Critical Mass is always one of the largest, with thousands of people expected on the streets and probably gathering, probably starting in the next half hour. And then once people have assembled, they'll take off. So we'll be here through 7 p.m. and then after that, Freak Radio Santa Cruz will be coming on the airwaves for an hour, followed by New York City and San Diego. So
come to Iraq with respect for its citizens, for their great civilization.
They keep on bombarding this area in front of us. Have they not finished with all these? Look, if they want to bombard the palaces, are they not our heritage? Because it is decreed, because it's the birthplace of our president, they went and bombarded one of the best museums in the country. Do you know that? Do you know they have attacked our university, which is called Muslim Sadia? Do you know they have attacked one of the oldest schools in the whole world, called Muslim Sadia School? Do you know that? Well, please tell your people, let them have a respect for human heritage. This is not Iraq's heritage only. It belongs to the whole world.
To the Iraqi people, let me say that the day of your liberation will soon be at hand.
Do you think we believe that you come to free us? Why can't you be either human or logical? You are neither human nor logical in this act. And I was surprised and shocked to hear people applauding your president this evening for the nonsense he was saying. Everybody knows it.
However long it takes to win, however long it takes to achieve our objective, and that's important for you to know, the American people to know, our allies to know, and the Iraqi people to know. However long it takes.
You should hear today the people who were bombarded in a very local, modest area where people go and have their fruits because we eat. Don't think we are hungry people. We have fresh fruit every day. We have fresh vegetables every day. People were going to shop, and there were two rockets on that area. Why? Why? What for?
We're working together to make the world more peaceful. We're working together to make our respective nations and all the free nations of the world more secure. And we're working to free the Iraqi people.
And you tell me you are here not for oil? What are you for then? Killing people? Just killing people like that?
I often try to put myself in other people's shoes and ask myself, in this case, for example, an Iraqi citizen, what they have to be seeing is a good deal of evidence that the Iraqi people want to be liberated.
Democracy doesn't come by rockets. Democracy comes by dialogue. Why do you want us to listen to your rockets? You talk about peace. You talk about having no interest in Iraq but to free Iraq. How could you free Iraq with your rockets and your bombardment?
And you are listening to Enemy Combatant Radio, and that is a collage that comes to us from some of the programmers at Freak Radio Santa Cruz, and I want to give a big shout out to the amazing production that they do, production work on audio, and that was a collage that was from an interview that Dennis Bernstein had done with heads of state, as you obviously will have recognized. And you are listening to Enemy Combatant Radio, and we're part of Critical Mass Radio Network at the moment. And we have a special guest in the studio with us, Dar Jamil, who is a reporter for KPFA, who has been to Iraq and is just back now, and I believe about to head out again to go back to do the coverage from, is it Baghdad?
Yeah, from Baghdad.
And let me see if I got you in the mic there, okay?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. And also we've got Adam here to help us, take us into some questions and think about the situations there in Iraq right now as we near the elections.
Yeah, it's great to have Dar in the studio because I attended a talk by him at Modern Times Bookstore last the Monday just gone, and you know, as someone who's aware that the corporate media is not representing the truth, you know, I feel like I understand that, you know, what I see on the television isn't actually what's happening out there. But I was, to say shocked, I think is a gross understatement. Because Dar's actually been there, and he's been amongst the people, and he's dodged the bullets, and he's encountered the roadblocks, and he's seen the death. You know, he's gone through the hospitals, and he's jumped over the pools of sewage in the streets. And it's a totally different side to what you'll see on in the media. I mean, if you go to abcnews.com today, you'll read about how the latest news dispatch from Iraq is about how a US general is saying that the opposition to the US bombing in Fallujah is weakening. And it's basically that the story is a direct quote from the general and no kind of investigation as to if he's telling the truth, no alternative sources. It's just a copy and paste, basically, of the words. And, you know, I feel that the mainstream media has fallen short of its task in challenging and informing and probing. Dara, I presume that's one reason why you went to Iraq in the first place, is to try and counter that.
Well said. That is the main reason I went. The mainstream, the corporate media, they shouldn't even be allowed to be called media. Journalism's dead in America, except for on the fringes. And what we're seeing in Iraq is the most blatant proof of that. Like, the media allowing itself to be used by the military to basically spew out propaganda to justify the upcoming invasion on Fallujah. It's a microcosm of what happened with the whole Iraq invasion. And we see real clearly where that has led, and it's just continuing. They're stenographers, they're not journalists. These people working in the mainstream, for the most part, basically just not doing their job.
Yeah, I mean, actually, when in the opening stages of the Iraq invasion, we saw over here, you know, actually embedded journalists with actual footage of bullets flying, but it was, and we were told that, you know, hey, look, here's pictures of what's going on. How can you have anything more accurate than this? But, you know, obviously you're seeing a totally different side over there.
Yeah, what's really happening in Iraq is it is genocide, especially now with the latest reports of upwards of 100,000 people potentially having been killed there.
Yeah.
You know, we've done in 18 months one third of what it took Saddam Hussein to do in 24 years as a dictator. We are going to surpass his mark at the rate this occupation is going within another couple of years max. So who is the rogue state? Who is the war criminal? And, you know, it's the U.S. government using the U.S. military. And this is simply not being reported over there. It's every day just slaughter in the streets of Iraqi civilians.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing because many of us are saying these things. You know, we realize how inaccurate the media, if that's what they're called, or you should call them, are reporting. But you actually made the jump to actually get over there and do that. I mean, we're one of four independent journalists in Iraq at that time?
At the last time, yeah. We were joking around at one point. It was myself and Christian Prinny, who writes for The Nation, and another independent journalist named Dave Enders, and then Rick Rowley, who works with Big Noise Films, was there. And there was four of us in this one hotel. And as far as all of us knew, we were the only independent media, alternative media folks from the U.S. there. The U.K. has maybe one or two with The Independent and The Guardian. But aside from that, especially from America, there's nobody there. And there's a desperate need for it now more than ever.
Yeah. How keen are the news sources in America and worldwide to pick up your stories and run with them?
Oh, they won't touch them. Any mainstream. I've actually had luck in other countries. For example, in Japan, my writing's been published in many other languages. But as far as U.S. mainstream, I've written stories that essentially, at one point last January, I wrote a story, a very in-depth story of a man who was detained and tortured into a coma. All of this, a very similar thing as to what you saw come out in April when the mainstream broke it. And that story was submitted to major news sources in the U.S. and no one would touch it.
Yeah.
And the question is why?
Interesting. Exactly why? So, I mean, moving on to your experience in Iraq itself, I mean, just give us a kind of a snapshot. What's it like, the day in the life of a normal Iraqi citizen in Baghdad or Sadr City, or, you know, from your experience, what's it like when they wake up, you know, from the time they go to sleep?
Well, it's a day in the life in Iraq for someone. They're looking for a job because they're 70% unemployment. So they're waking up wondering how they're going to bring in some sort of money to feed their family. Every car in Baghdad is a taxi because everyone will pick you up and give you a ride because that's one way to make money. So so they'll drive their car around, for example, as a taxi, and they will probably have to be very fearful about a car bomb, for example. So any time, any place in Baghdad, car bomb could go off. Another thing is U.S. patrols. They're always basically moving targets, so if they're driving around, they have to avoid those. They won't find a job because as the situation continues further in time, there's fewer and fewer jobs even. That situation is getting worse. Back at home, they're having, at best case scenario, maybe 8 hours of electricity per day. Mm-hmm. If they drink the water out of the taps, they're going to have nausea, diarrhea, dysentery, possibly cholera. If they live in Sadr City, they'll for sure either get cholera, typhoid, or hepatitis E, mm-hmm. Drinking water from the taps that Bechtel's responsible for rehabilitating the treatment centers of, for the most part. And it's a dismal situation. They have no hope because their country's occupied. They're living under an interim government that's been backed and installed and maintained by the U.S. These upcoming elections in January, no one really pays them any heed because they figure it'll be rigged just like everything else there has been. Mm-hmm. It's a dismal situation and there's no hope. And demonstrations have been outlawed by the U.S.-backed interim government. So mm-hmm. really, the people have no effective ways of causing change in their own society aside from the violent Iraqi resistance. And that's why its ranks are swelling. And it's actually because of economic reasons is another reason why it's growing. So it's a dismal, dismal situation there. And basically, people are in survival mode.
And how do the people view the American invaders?
Well, 90% of the people there now are totally opposed to the occupation. And over 90% of the people openly express their support of the Iraqi resistance. They do view the U.S. as occupiers. Every time there is a car bomb, they blame the U.S. Because rightfully so. It's the U.S. military's responsibility to provide security. So every time a car bomb goes off, the U.S. is blamed for that. And some people distrust the U.S. enough that think that they're the ones behind the car bombs and they're the ones behind the bombings of the mosques. So the anti-American sentiment there is really through the roof.
There was another Bay Area reporter, David Martinez, who has been out in Iraq, and he came back with this story that described somebody explaining if you have a box of 20 mice or something and how you would get them to line up in a row. And the thing was to put them all in a box to take the box and shake it up as much as you could. And then when you take the mice out, they're so disoriented, you could just take them and line them up. And that seemed to be like what you're describing, this analogy, what the U.S. is doing to the Iraqi people is just to mess up their civilization so much that all they can do is they're stunned and there's incredible confusion and upheaval in their society. And I was just wondering also from your perspective how the people are trying to organize, if they are trying to rebuild their society. They're not. Are they trying to communicate to the organizations that would be coming from the outside to rebuild whatever infrastructure that's supposed to be being rebuilt? Who are they communicating? Is there communication going on with these organizations from the outside that they're able to get to them to have those conversations?
That's a good analogy. I like it because I think that analogy of the mice in the box is appropriate because it is essentially the end goal of the shock and awe military campaign, which actually that phrase comes from a 1996 document that's basically a military strategy that its goal is basically to destroy the will of the people and to disorient them and to just basically cause massive shell shock so then they can go in and do what they need to do for as long as they want to be there. And that is essentially what's happened. The people, their infrastructure is shattered, the state is gone, there is you know, what the civilization is smashed. And as far as them having contact with other people to come in and try to rebuild, there really is, they have contact, of course, with phones and email, but there simply is no way that outside companies can now come in. All of the Western contracts, the way basically Bremer and Company came in under the Coalition Provisional Authority and essentially wrote these Bremer orders that literally snatched the economy from under the Iraqis. The U.S. has control of their oil. They have control of all the infrastructure, and they opened up all the markets to foreign bidding and ownership, and banks are now legally 50% of banks are owned by outside interests. I mean, it literally has taken their entire country from underneath them, so they are left with no recourse. And getting other companies in there, aside from a few individuals in literal grassroots situations where people like myself might bring in like an extra suitcase full of medical supplies. But aside from that, there's really just not too much going on because of the security situation is so horrible.
You've talked specifically, it's on your website, and also it was in your talk on Monday, about Bechtel, who were contracted to deal with the water and the wastewater systems in Iraq. And I think according to a report, they were meant to have, within a year from April 2003, all major cities connected back to the water systems and, you know, all stations normal. But it, from your experience in Iraq, that Bechtel have not even really begun to do anything.
They have begun. It's a very feeble beginning at best. You're right. They specifically mention four water treatment plants in their implementation plan of the contract. And I visited three of those. And of the three I went to, the best case scenario was that one of them, the head engineer said, yes, some subcontractors of Bechtel came by and they replaced our sand filters, but that didn't even increase our potable water supply. So in the worst case scenario was one of the head engineers at a different plant said, Bechtel who? There is simply, if any rebuilding is going on now, I would be shocked. There was a little bit at the beginning, but now, of course, again, with the security situation, there is none. And then the flip side of that, well, Bechtel says, because the security is so bad, we can't do it. We'll wait until things get a little better. And then that begs the question of why won't they hire Iraqis to do the work? And they won't hire Iraqis because they don't trust them. They're afraid they might be part of the resistance or there to sabotage. But they're just simply not doling out the contracts and hiring Iraqis, which is, again, leading to even more support of the resistance.
And what was the size of the Bechtel contract?
The initial contract was $680 million. Mm-hmm. Now their contract is worth well up over $1 billion.
Wow.
And they keep getting these increases. Because the thing with these contracts is they're cost plus, which means they will get paid no matter what, even if they don't do the work. Mm-hmm. And they're guaranteed a 1% profit at least. And then they're subject to bonuses as well. So the big question is, you know, all U.S. taxpayers are paying this money. Where is it going? It's the work simply not getting done on the ground in Iraq. And here's Bechtel, though, posting record profits.
That's shocking. And just tell us briefly, what are Bechtel's links to government and other business? Was Paul Bremer not on the director board?
I don't know that Bremer was. I know that they're a huge contributor, of course, to the Bush campaign. Mm-hmm. But as far as direct links within that organization, I actually haven't researched that myself, other than they are a big Republican Party funder, as well as they fund the Democratic Party as well. But, of course, the Republicans have a big lead in campaign funding.
Yeah, okay. We've got to be introducing our next guest fairly soon, I believe. But just before we go, I don't know if anyone has any final questions, but one I certainly have is, where do you see this going for the people of Iraq? Are we heading towards any kind of climax in any kind of process here?
Well, the immediate climax will be Fallujah. It looks like another siege of Fallujah is imminent. It could happen any day now. And I think we will see a similar situation as to what happened in April, as far as it will galvanize the entire country against the occupiers, except this time it's going to be much more intense because now Fallujah is and has been for quite a while the symbol of Iraqi resistance. And the thing that I've been hearing from my friends in Iraq is that Iraq is Fallujah and Fallujah is Iraq. Mm. And so if the U.S. military tries to take it again, I think we're going to see fighting on a scale that we haven't seen since probably the invasion.
And you're heading back to Iraq fairly soon, aren't you?
I am, real soon, yeah. I plan to be in Baghdad by November 5th.
Okay. Dar actually posts reports regularly on his website, and if you want to check that out, it's an excellent website.
It's darjamailiraq.com, and that's DarjamailIraq, and I imagine that's going to be linked to KPFA's website as well, so from Flashpoints you might be able to find that. And we really want to thank you for coming in, and thank you so much for the work that you're doing, and we wish you all the safety and all much success getting your message out to the rest of the media. We're a very small, a grassroots media organization, and trying to get this kind of news out through net streaming and whatever radio waves we can here through Critical Mass Radio Network is a bit of a larger experiment going on, and we'd be happy to take reports from you if you have any time while you're over in Iraq to help get that out.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, I'd be happy to, and what you're doing here is what it's going to take to just disseminate the information and try to get it out to more folks. So thanks again for having me.
Yeah, thanks very much.
And we'll take a quick musical break, and we've got many things coming up in this show. So we've got Siafu waiting outside, and Mark, you want to tell us what else is coming up?
Coming up next, we have Ren from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who will be talking briefly with us about their campaign on electronic voting and, you know, questions of how safe and secure are the election systems here in California and across the U.S. So stay tuned to Enemy Combatant Radio. All right, we're back here on Enemy Combatant Radio. This is the Critical Mass Radio Network, the last Friday of every month. And right now we're speaking with Ren from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Welcome, Ren. So we're going to be talking, I guess, mostly about your campaign on electronic voting, which is obviously coming to a head here with the election just a few days away.
Mm-hmm.
Also in the studio we have Occupant. Who's working over in Alameda County on the elections over there, so he could share some insight of what it's like to actually be working around these electronic voting machines. But could you tell us, Ren, a little bit about the work that EFF is doing on this issue?
Sure. Well, we've been doing a bunch of different things over the course of the last year, but most recently we started working on something that's specific to California. And California is kind of unique in the country because we're the only state where we have electronic voting machines, and we have by law now, the Secretary of State issued an order which requires it, that if somebody doesn't trust the machines or doesn't want to vote on an electronic voting machine, that they can actually request a paper ballot. And so they have, California voters have this kind of paper or plastic option, and they have since April. The trouble is that, and this is why our most recent campaign got kicked off, but the trouble is that we found out about a week and a half ago that of the 10 counties that are using electronic voting in the November 2nd election, we found out that at least three of them have been explicitly telling their poll workers not to inform the public and not to inform voters about the choice that they have. They said basically only if the voter comes up and explicitly asks you, are you allowed to give them a paper ballot? And so we felt that this was a violation, certainly of the spirit of the law, if not the if not the letter of it. And so we kicked off this campaign called Paper or Plastic 2004, and you can go to paperorplastic2004.org to check it out. Where basically we're trying to educate people that they have this choice. And one of the cool things about that site actually is that it's the animation and the site are not only in English but also in Chinese, Tagalog, and Spanish. So we think it's really important that a lot of minority language communities know about this as well.
Yeah, Ren, I could this occupant. I'm doing the poll working over in Alameda County. I could definitely confirm that that is the case. Although in the classroom, they did say that we can offer those, that there is a provisional ballot available, a paper ballot. If you look through the precinct board member instructions, they leave out the fact that you're supposed to tell anybody about paper or plastic.
Right, yeah, that's the other thing that we've seen is that sometimes they're explicitly telling people not to tell the people about the choice, and in other cases they're not even telling the poll workers about it. I think that what you're mentioning there is kind of indicative of the larger problem of them just kind of wanting to hush this up so that after the election they can say, look, everybody loved these electronic voting machines, nobody asked for a paper ballot. And our position is that, if you don't tell them about it and if you don't do your job in educating the public and your poll workers, then that's obviously something you could expect. But thanks, by the way, for being a poll worker in Alameda County. I should mention that Alameda County, which includes Oakland and Berkeley, is one of the 10 counties in California that's going to use touchscreen machines in this next election, and the rest of them are Santa Clara, Orange, Napa, San Bernardino, Merced, Plumas, Shasta, Tehama, and Riverside counties.
Wow. So could you tell us a little bit about what are the problems with electronic voting, especially in California with the Diebold technology that's being used?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, the chief problem, just kind of the most basic problem with the machines is that, it's kind of twofold. The first is that that they're proprietary systems that we and the public basically can't take a look under the hood. Even election officials who are buying hundreds of millions of dollars of the machines are usually covered by non-disclosure agreements that kind of prevents them from opening the machines up to an independent third-party review. Even though they're tested at the federal level, the results of the testing are held under non-disclosure agreements. And so kind of these things were really kind of enigmas up until about a year and a half ago when we when people started really pushing on the vendors and election officials to get a better look inside. And when they eventually did, and this is with the Diebold machines that they're going to be using a version of the Diebold machines that they're going to be using in Alameda County, every independent study that's come out so far has kind of underscored that we should really be worried about the machines because they have so many problems that are just kind of baked in at very basic levels. So that's the first problem, is kind of the proprietary nature and then also the sketchiness of the technology, if you will, because we have had reports now reliably from about these Diebold machines. The second problem is more it's almost more fundamental, which is that in a democracy, it's not just important that you count every vote and that there is election integrity, but that it's provable. You're not just taking the word of some bureaucrat that the election went well. You have to have an audit trail. You have to be able to conduct a recount. You have to do all of that transparently, so that the public can have confidence in the results. And that's something that these machines are really bad at, because none of them, most of them that are deployed right now, none of them in California, produce something called a voter verified paper audit trail. So none of them right now, if the power goes out and if there's, a question about, malfeasance, voter fraud or some other kind of malfunction, there's nothing to go back and count. We thought the 2000 was bad because it took us, a few weeks to count the hanging chads and stuff. This time there may not even be that cold comfort.
So now what about the fact that they use the Windows operating system and they could crash or just like fail to work altogether? Has that happened before, and is that a big concern for EFF, and I guess maybe it might also be concerned for Occupant, who's going to have to work with them?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the reliability of the machines, above and beyond kind of like the problems with the integrity in terms of, being able to verify that the machines did the right thing. The reliability has definitely been an issue. We've seen a number of different kinds and different flavors of, some people call them glitches, some people call them malfunctions. We've definitely seen some technical difficulties with the machines. In some cases, it's something where, the batteries don't charge up correctly. In other cases, it's something where a poll worker error has led to the machine, kind of loading up with the wrong ballot, as opposed to, it will bring up the Democratic ballot as opposed to the Republican ballot when the voter has requested one or the other, those kinds of things. And I guess all of this goes to the point, which is that this is the first election where a huge number of Americans are going to be voting on the machines. About 30% of the voting public lives in districts that have these machines now, so that's about 50 million people. And almost all of it was kind of deployed within the last 3 or 4 years. And the poll worker training and the back end preparation for the systems, it just really hasn't happened. I mean, if we were in South Carolina right now, I'd be really worried, because they just purchased a system in the last 2 months and they're trying to implement it before the election on Tuesday. And that to us is just crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. If I could, there's some. The flaws that I've seen with the AccuVote TS, the one that we're using over in Alameda County, is this runs on a PCMCIA card. It's like a laptop. It also is supposed to be matched up with a printout that only does the entire day's worth of votes on that machine. Now, if those are off, we know that there's a problem, but we don't know what the problem is in there.
Right, and you don't know which one is right either.
Exactly.
So what you were just – is that Occupant?
Yes.
So what Occupant is just describing was what some people will point to and say, oh, yeah, we've got a paper trail on the machine. It prints out the person's choice every time they make one, and we have this kind of contemporaneous paper trail that gets printed all the time. But what they don't mention is that this thing is printing inside of a locked box at the back of the machine. So the voter doesn't get to take a look at the thing and say, "Oh, actually, that's wrong. The machine has messed up my choice here." Instead, what happens is at the end of the day, this big long reel of paper with all the choices on it is taken out of the machine. But there's no way to tell actually if that machine or if the choices on the paper were actually the choices that the people in the voting booths are making. So it's kind of a silly thing, right? I mean, it's the point is to be able to give the public some kind of faith or some kind of some reason to believe that their choices, their real world choices, really did make it into the land of bits and bytes.
The other thing is, if these votes do not come out on, because they're all consolidated on a supervisor card at the end. Mm-hmm. Now, if those votes do not match all the votes that that happened on the roster is the way they're supposed to be, again, you know that there's a problem, but you don't know where it is.
Right. Exactly. It becomes very difficult to track those things down. You know, and I should point out too. I mean, and I always make a point of saying this whenever we go out and talk about these issues, is that as far as we can tell, the majority of these machines do don't have any kind of catastrophic failure that we can tell. You know, I mean, we can't. Most of them start up on time. Most of them don't shut down in the middle of the day and lose all their votes. And so while, we deal with a lot with worst-case scenarios, and so when you hear us talking about the machines, we kind of gravitate towards the horror stories and kind of how to deal with those worst-case scenarios. And I should point out that the surest way to make sure that your vote doesn't count is to not cast one. And so no matter what you hear, whether it's our conversation today or if it's other kinds of conversations about Election Day, I mean, the most important thing is to get out to the polls so that we have somebody to fight for.
Well, what else can people do on Election Day if they run into trouble? Are there hotlines they can call or something?
Absolutely.
Like?
There's this year, I mean, one of the most amazing things about working on this issue for the last year or so, year and a half or so, has been to see how much organizational muscle has been applied to this problem. And this year, if you're anywhere in the country and you have a problem, if you call 1-866-OUR-VOTE, it brings you to the Election Protection Hotline. And Election Protection is a coalition of groups including EFF and People for the American Way and Verified Voting and the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights, a bunch of really big, nonprofit groups. And what they're doing basically is they've trained 50,000 people who are going to be in all across the United States, not in every state, but in the states any state where they are, there's going to be somebody in each of the polling places, or two people actually in each of the polling places.
These are poll watchers?
And we're going to have national hotlines throughout the country so that if you get to your polling place and the somebody hassles you about ID, if they refuse to give you a provisional ballot, if you have a problem with the machine, if you call 1-866-OUR-VOTE, then there will be somebody there who can route you to the right place and give you a helping hand. If need be, we can also we have lawyers on standby and techs on standby who can help you resolve the problem.
Do you have poll watchers coming out? So?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in about 16 states, I think we're going to have a pair of poll watchers in every single polling place.
What about the central locations where they're actually tabulating the results from all these machines? I mean, how do you know that they're not going to open up those Microsoft database files and change the contents or something like that?
Mm-hmm. At that level, at the point where they become tabulated centrally, it's a little bit harder because I think basically at that point you're relying on the adversarial nature of politics, right? Where if all the procedures are followed, those files are never left alone with somebody from a single party. That there's always going to be people from both parties who are supposedly going to be, kind of watching each other's backs or making sure, keeping each other honest. So hopefully those procedures will be followed. I mean, this is, again, to kind of underscore the complexity of this problem. I mean, there's a technical angle, there's a training angle, there's a logistical angle where, you have to, not only do you have to have machines that work, but you have to train people on how to use them and help other people use them. And also you have to have good, sound procedures for taking care of these pieces of what are really evidence. I mean, you have to have a chain of custody for these things that whether it's a flashcard or a paper tape or whatever it is, you have to have good procedures and follow them.
So, Ren, the whole voting system is being protected only by two parties.
What's that? Oh, I don't mean to make it sound like there's only two parties, but those are in general the in most of the. in most of the places, it is going to be representatives from the two major parties who are going to be doing the kind of scrutineering.
I'm sure we can rely on them, right?
Well, I will say that, you know, whatever you think about them on their own, when they get head-to-head, you can pretty much, you know, count on how they're going to act when in competition with one another.
Yeah, well, we can hope. Well, I'm sure this is going to be a scary election for a lot of people, and I'm sure that they appreciate the work that you guys are doing.
Well, thank you very much. And if I could just one more time plug the website. If you have friends, if you live in one of these counties, or if you, or even if you don't and you have friends who you think might live in them, check out paperorplastic2004.org. There's some information there, and it's presented in a kind of an easy to understand way, so that if you didn't know that you had the right to request a paper ballot, that you know, this is a good way to reinforce that.
Brent, I do have a question from a former poll worker who had done this before. He had some problems telling people about their rights in voting before, and now we have this situation where I intended to tell our voters, you know, whether they for their options on paper and plastic, and also the handicapped on their options as well.
Mm-hmm.
I had another person who had a problem with his other board members saying that, oh, you shouldn't really say that. We don't want you to say any of those things, mm-hmm. The inspectors and such. Now, as a poll worker, do I have any rights to continue telling people about people?
Oh, do you have the right to basically to deviate from the training?
Well, yeah, and to let people know, hey, they got those options.
Right. You know, it's an interesting question. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't speak to the legal end of it, but I think that that they would be hard pressed to punish you for telling people about their rights. I think that, you know, to the extent that they could, you know, pull you from being a poll worker, that they could try to do that, but I don't know that there's any other kind of legal levers they could pull in order to keep you from doing that. But again, I'm not a lawyer, and so I don't want to get disbarred before I even try to become one.
Yeah, because one of the things I find really interesting about the fact that if we push the provisional voting, what they've been saying is that they have enough provisional votes for whoever asks for them or whoever needs them. If they require more, that might let them know, hey, people are more interested in having the paper than mm-hmm. than these electronics.
Right, and that's one of the tough things here is that since the since in California, you know, you have a right to a paper ballot, but that they're going to be counted with the other provisional ballots, which are, for people who don't know what a provisional ballot is, it's for people who show up at a polling place who are sure that they're registered to vote, but, you know, for some whatever reason aren't on the rolls in this polling place. You know, this is actually, it's kind of like an emergency paper ballot that they're allowed to fill out. And in California, we actually have a pretty good law, which means that law about provisional ballots, which says that you know they're always going to get counted. It's not like they're going to get thrown out. It just means that you have to sign an extra declaration and make sure that you're that you've affirmed that everything's above board and that you didn't vote via mail or something earlier. And part of the trouble is that the people who choose to use a paper ballot in this election, they're going to be lumped with the other folks' provisional ballots. And so it'll be tough after the fact to figure out, you know, if California had more provisional ballots because more people requested them for reasons other than kind of mistrusting the machines. And so it'll be interesting to see what those numbers are like after the election.
Well, we really have to move on to our next guest, I guess.
There's so much.
Unless you have a last word.
No, there's a lot more on this, but I mean, we definitely.
We'll have to have a follow up show. we could have Occupant and EFF and Verified Voting maybe back on the air to tell us how things went on election day.
I'd enjoy that. Yeah, I'm going to be in Ohio actually for the election, so I'll maybe give you a report from Columbus.
Wow, that's a good hotspot.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ryan.
Talk to you later.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, this is Enemy Combatant Radio, and we're going to be switching over to the Beyond Voting segment of the show pretty soon. We have some folks from SIAFU coming on the air. We're going to be talking about the organizing work they're doing for the day after elections, November 3rd. So stay tuned to Critical Mass Radio. Coming at you from San Francisco until 7 p.m. Pacific time. And then we'll be switching over to Santa Cruz Freak Radio for an hour from 7 to 8 p.m. www.criticalmassradio.net and enemycombatantradio.net. Listening to Enemy Combatant Radio on the Critical Mass Radio Network, and we're going to go into a little bit more on the election right now. Beyond Voting will be coming up next, but we have here in the studio Jonah and David from the No on Measure Y campaign in Oakland. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having us.
So now I live in Oakland, so I'm glad we can have some airtime on local issues here on Enemy Combatant Radio. Could you tell people a little bit about Measure Y? Like, whose idea was it? What is it going to do? Why should people vote against it?
Well, Measure Y is a parcel tax increase, a property tax increase, that was placed on the Oakland ballot by the Oakland City Council. And in the process of putting it on there, they billed it as an anti-violence measure. The parcel tax would raise.
I think it's $20 million a year that it would raise.
And so, out of the $20 million, the bulk of that would be used to hire 63 more police officers in the city of Oakland. And our position is that more police officers don't equal less violence, and that the way you reach a point where you have less violence in the city is by developing job programs and educational programs and programs that help young people particularly to understand the root causes of violence and to be able to relate to each other in a different way.
And I think you've put it really well in an article that he wrote, that it's a march towards a whiter, more militarized Oakland. That's really what it stands for. It's been part of a whole series of initiatives to try to get more cops in Oakland that Oakland keeps shooting down.
And really, it's about the gentrification process. It's militarizing the community, making it more comfortable for more wealthy white folks to move into the community and take over different spaces. So I think that a big part of the incentive or the impetus behind Measure Y is the gentrification of Oakland. And I think that's important for people to recognize when they think about why to vote against it.
Now, how would these funds be raised? Would it be paid for by the wealthy, the poor, that middle class? Who's going to be paying for it?
Well, that's one of the issues we have with it. It's a parcel tax. It's a flat tax. So everyone pays the same amount in Oakland. So if you're a poor property owner or living in the Oakland Hills in a $3 million home, you're paying the same amount. And there's even a clause in there that states specifically that this tax can be passed on to renters. So really, it's the poorest people paying for an initiative that's against their own personal interests. And the way the city of Oakland's been trying to sell it with these like slick mailers and slick phone messages is that it's their 40% of the money is actually going to go to real violence prevention programs. And they're trying to hide the fact that a majority of the money is going to militarizing our community to more cops.
In effect, Mark, after having tried several times to fund additional police officers and been unsuccessful, they've now partnered the funding for police officers with some minor funding for community development and social development programs.
And that was basically a way to buy off the progressives and get some major progressive leaders like Nancy Nadel or Barbara Lee to get behind it. And basically they feel like there's so little funding for social programs in Oakland that they'll take what they get. But we feel like it's not a compromise that we can't accept 63 more cops, and we can't accept a movement for more cops in Oakland. And that's what this really represents, is this right-wing movement. They want 300 more cops is really what they're asking for and what they're putting out there.
Now, Oakland does seem to have a lot of financial problems. There's school closures. You see parks that are fenced off. I don't even know if that's for lack of money or what. But, what are the alternatives out there? I mean, can Oakland really afford other programs like violence prevention? What does that mean? Like, I don't think people really know what a violence prevention program is. That's just a kind of abstract term.
Well, Mark, money's tight all over, and the city of Oakland is no exception. But I think the real question is how you spend the money. The annual budget that the city is working with is $300+ million a year. And so what it comes down to is how you prioritize your spending of the money. And what we need is we need to have leadership in the form of elected officials who are able to represent the needs of the citizens of Oakland in a more direct manner, as opposed to elected officials and other leaders who are out there playing political games for their own gain.
And I think, they know what the needs are of the people of Oakland. That's why when we get our phone messages or our mailers, they're talking about things like after-school programs. They're talking about intervention programs for youth who have witnessed violence. What our community needs, like if youth are off the street in recreation centers, if youth have opportunities, then they're not going to be getting in trouble. Then they're not going to be doing things that lead to violence. If our city has employment, we show over the last 30 years that unemployment and homicide rates are directly correlated in Oakland. The number of cops in Oakland and homicide rates have nothing to do with each other. And we've had some people come out and speak as part of the No on Measure Y campaign whose children have been killed by the Oakland police or the San Francisco police. And for them, it's very real that police are not a prevention of homicide, but actually are part of a cycle of violence and part of a process of violence. And 70% of the Oakland police are not from Oakland. So really, a lot of people, including myself, see the police as an occupying force, really similar to the way we might be occupying Iraq, that we're militarizing our community, and who benefits and who gets put in prison, I think, is a really significant issue. So what we're trying to do with education, not incarceration, which is where we're coming from, is say that if we fund social programs, if we fund job training, if we fund education and housing and adequate food, if we fund health care, that those are the real problems, that that's the real violence in our community, a lack of those things. And if we create a real healthy community, that's how we stop violence, not by militarizing our streets with more police.
Yeah, what I saw was that there is a direct correlation between the number of police and the number of homicides, and it was a complementary correlation where the more police, the more homicides, and the fewer police, the fewer homicides. So I don't know what that means, but certainly some sociologists could maybe try to get to the root of that one. But what are people doing? I mean, we just have a few days until the election, and obviously the Yes on Why campaign has been well funded from what I can tell. What are you guys doing in the next few days to try to get the word out about what Measure Y is going to do and how people should vote?
Well, Mark, we've been continuing our No on Measure Y campaign through phone banking and attending community events, organizing community events, community forums, workshops, speaking at with local church groups, working with the unions, just contacting across the spectrum of the community, individuals, and working on getting the word out. Now, there are a number of specific opportunities that people have a chance to plug into over the next couple of days if they want to join us.
And I think that it's important to note that our involvement in this campaign was about building a grassroots movement. It was about changing the media message to say, do police really make us safer? And raise that question in the mainstream media and the alternative press, and really talk about the fact that police are not making our community safer. So when we got involved with this campaign, we're like, well, we'd like to beat the measure, but realistically, we're up against an enormous amount of money, and we have relatively little electoral experience. We have a lot of grassroots experience. But we decided that we wanted to fight it by running a media campaign and running a publicity campaign. So we've been out there jamming them up in the media. Every step they've taken with this campaign, we've been out there to fight them in the media, to put out a counter message. And it's been really powerful that we've been able to get a message out in the media that really questions, it really shows people from the Oakland community questioning the fact that police are making us safer in any way. And yeah, there are statistics all over the place showing the higher number of police, cities with higher number of police have a higher homicide rate. And I think that part of that is just the atmosphere that police create. That police create an atmosphere of hate. They create an atmosphere of anger within the community. They divide people up. So I don't think that it's entirely just coincidental. Some of the events that we're doing coming up, a lot of them are hooked up with the organizations that we've networked with and that we built power with through this campaign. So tomorrow, Saturday, we're meeting up at 10 o'clock at the Acorn office at 3616 Fruitvale to go out. Or no, I'm sorry. Tomorrow we're meeting at Californians for Justice, which is 1611 Telegraph. And we're going to be going out and walking precincts there with folks from Californians for Justice. On Sunday, we're meeting up at Acorn, which is 3616 Fruitvale Avenue, and we're going out to Dia de los Muertos, which is 80,000 folks celebrating out in Fruitvale. And we're going to flyer there and hold up signs and just encourage people in Oakland to vote no on Measure Y. Monday, we're doing a rally before the start of the Riders trial. The Riders retrial is starting on Monday.
Oh, wow.
Oakland Riders.
That's a good coincidence right there.
Yeah, it's very nice for us. And a lot of stuff like that has happened. The Karijama, the tear gassing of folks inside buildings in Wendy's and stuff like that during the Karijama festival by the Oakland police. Mm-hmm. The hearing on that just happened yesterday.
Oh, so, wow.
But the Oakland,
well, I should have asked you for a report on that. But
yeah, it was a really powerful hearing. A lot of folks just talked about what an intense experience it was to have smoke bombs and tear gas going off inside a building when they were just hanging out there with their kids, and how violent the Oakland police were against people who were just trying to have a good time.
That was a crazy story. Yeah. I just saw the pictures, but Yeah, I mean, sounded pretty insane.
And it's really intense, some of this stuff. And people should check out our website, noonmeasurewhy.org, to see our flyers and to share it with folks. Because it's really intense, some of the images that we've pulled out in this campaign and some of the stories. So Monday is the beginning of the retrial of the Oakland rioters, of the folks who came around and just like basically acted like a gang. And I think the whole police are kind of like a gang, but they were very explicitly a gang, just picking people up, making up stories, kidnapping people, falsely arresting people, planting evidence. Which is something that happens all throughout Oakland. It's not just the rioters, and people in Oakland recognize that. But that, so that trial starts on Monday at 10 o'clock at the Oakland courthouse, and we're going to have a press conference before that at 9:30.
Is that trial just the former police who are still in town? Because I know at least one of them fled the country or something. Is he on trial or did he escape?
No, he's in Mexico right now.
So he escaped justice totally.
Well, all of them escaped justice. Well, but yeah, he, of course. But he fled justice.
Right.
I mean, the fact that there is a retrial happening, that the jury couldn't go ahead and say that these people are guilty when it's so clear they're guilty, is really disgusting. But we're going to be out there just to make sure people recognize what more police in Oakland means and what building that institution means.
Well, at least we convinced Chief Ward to leave town.
Yeah, we got one down. And I think that we have a lot of power right now to show this city that the city doesn't want to go into receivership. They don't want their police department taken over by the state. And we can show the city right now by really making some noise that we need a police chief that really is going to be accountable for the community. And we're some of us have been supporting this dude, Ron Davis, who has done a lot of work with stopping racial profiling and working with building accountable relationships. And I mean, for me, I don't support the prison industrial complex or the institution of the police at all. But I think that in the process, we have to be trying to challenge and bring in people who are really going to change the institution.
Well, can you guys give us a phone number and website for people to get involved in the next few days?
People should go to noonmeasurewhy.org, and all of our events coming up this weekend are up there. So if you missed any, we're doing a rally on Tuesday and a bunch of other stuff Tuesday. So,
and the phone number?
And I would say the best number to call is 510-530-2448. Again, it's 510-530-2448, and our website's noonmeasurewhy.org.
Okay, well, thank you both, David and Jonah, for being here on the show tonight. Good luck in the next few days getting the word out. And hopefully we could have you back on after the election to give a report on the success story of of a grassroots campaign.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
So we'll see you next time. All right, Enemy Combatant Radio, we're going to be coming back in just a few minutes with the Beyond Voting segment, so stay tuned.
Isn't a rock, keeps pumping, isn't a rock, dog red and clean. is interrupt and be enjoy. Is interrupt, let come fly back. Is interrupt, keeps pumping pump. Is interrupt, our grin and clear.
This is Enemy Combatant Radio coming at you on the Critical Mass Radio Network. We're broadcasting live from San Francisco right now. And I guess Critical Mass here in San Francisco is just about to be getting underway, so maybe we'll have a report coming in from there later on to see how many people are out there on the streets tonight. But in the studio right now, we have Greg and Niall from Siafu, who've been organizing. Let me give you guys some mics here. You can each have a mic. So they've been organizing around the Beyond Voting campaign, which is trying to get people out on the streets on November 3rd. So welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you. Right on.
So why don't you tell folks what's going on the 3rd and how are you involved in it and what can people expect?
The 3rd? There's two major actions that are going on in the morning at Justice Herman Plaza. There's Code Blue, which is a group made up of physicians, activists who are working on a campaign called Healthcare Not Warfare. They're going to be going around San Francisco to various areas, marching through, going by hotels, going by the Chinese Progressive Association. And then later that evening at 5 o'clock in Powell and Market, there's a Nyon March, not in our name march, that'll be marching through the Mission. And that's going to be dealing with the issues of that no matter who wins in this presidency, there will still be war, there will still be occupation, there will still be, you know, millions uninsured, there will still be police violence in this country. So.
And pretty much Siafu, which is a Bay Area collective, anti-imperialist collective of people of color, queer folks, and anti-racist white allies, we'll be coming together to work with the anti-imperialist contingent, which is pretty much what Greg was just mentioning, the collective of folks. And we're pretty much going to show, we're going to be doing chants and just pretty much honoring the power of the people and supporting the work and building this movement against anti-imperialist, well, not anti-imperialist, but against Bush and the administration.
Also, the Day of the Dead. Right. Is around this time of year also. And so in terms of honoring the dead that are the victims of imperialism here mm-hmm. and abroad is a major aspect of the anti-imperialist contingent, which is part of the Nyon March.
Right. So could you tell us a little bit about Siafu? What does that word mean, and what is the organization all about?
Siafu, the term means, it's pretty much, it's a West African colonies of ants, pretty much of primarily just nothing but women. It has the capacity to take down large animals, including elephants, and they also have an amazing capacity to organize and use different type of techniques to pretty much move the colony. And so we pretty much chose that name to represent our technical strategies and trying to deal with some of the things that have been going on since Bush administration in particular, but also in preparing for the RNC and also doing work around voter registration. So that's pretty much the book. It's a contingent, like I mentioned, of people of color, anti-racist white allies, queer folks, transgender folks, who are just pretty much organizers, educators, a part of mass-based organizations, and who are just dedicated to just pretty much bringing the people out and also to make some change in the community, also in the nation and the world, primarily from that point. Yeah.
So how many people do you think are going to be out on the streets on Wednesday, the day after the election? Are we talking hundreds of people, thousands? I mean, we haven't had a huge protest, anti-war protest in San Francisco for a little while, so it's hard to know like how much consciousness is there out there right now.
Well, I think with the situation right now is that just based on what people are hearing just about the voting and everything, just like the blatant fraud that's been happening all over the country, really has a lot of people watching what is going to happen with this election. I think just the anger about that kind of situation, that people are realizing that just something that they take for granted as a basic right that they believe is part of this democracy is definitely not something to be taken for granted. And that's definitely putting, I would say thousands will be out there. This is my hope.
Yeah, I hope for tens of thousands, because what we're seeing now is that democracy is in crisis, and we're really trying to mobilize people to pretty much come out and support this action. So I'm seeing like tens of thousands of people here. A lot of people are really pumped up about what's been going on, primarily around watching the debates and seeing the differences in the two candidates and what did not show the rest of the candidates, and are just very, a lot of people are very just angry, probably upset, probably just want to voice some concerns. And I feel like just based on those things, a lot of people should come out and just support this action.
Now, what about election fraud and another stolen election? I mean, we've already seen a lot. We've seen ballots that are like tens of thousands of ballots are missing. We have these caging lists of voters that are going to be challenged at the polling places. A whole bunch of other things I can't even remember right now, but I mean, there's been so many weird things happening in the last, just in the past week. Is that a big variable? I mean, to me, there's already enough to protest. I mean, what more will it take to trigger like a mass, you know, protest?
People organizing in those in Florida and Ohio.
One of the members of CIAFA definitely went out there.
It's actually a couple. It's like three members right now in CIAFA.
Okay, yeah. So I mean, they're just bringing back all kinds of crazy stories. I mean, people are out there. It's like it's Republicans, it's Democrats, it's people on the left, it's people all over, like trying to really work. Well, I mean, some people are trying to swing the election. Some people are just trying to make sure that people are allowed to just have that right and like bring up the fact that people are being turned away at the polls, or their registration are being ripped up, and really trying to. I mean, you know, 2000 really brought that to light, and it's been going on before that, but this time around, people are seriously organizing around it.
Yeah, and also just particularly in Florida, just the systematic impacts around just the criminal justice system and limiting primarily people of color, predominantly African Americans, from vote based on their records. And so that's just been an issue just historically, but as we can see right now, it's going to really get people to mobilize after they're seeing what happened in the year 2000 when Bush and falsely been elected as our president, and Gore just sitting there not really doing anything about it. So we're going to see that this voting situation is going to have to be really seriously examined, and also for us to just start thinking about ways in which we can strategically make some change around this issue.
So are you guys going to be on the streets Wednesday morning? Because I know there's basically like a rally in March, 9 a.m. Wednesday morning. Are you going to be at that and also the 5 p.m. thing, or just one or the other?
In force, CIAFA and the anti-imperialist contingent will be active as a whole during the evening.
Okay.
And then, I mean, it's Code Blues action in the morning.
Right.
There'll be people who can make it at that time will be going. I mean, I personally will be going.
Mm-hmm. And Greg's going to be speaking on behalf of CIAFA and just talking about more about these issues as well.
So at 9 a.m.?
At 9 a.m. morning.
Okay.
At the rally.
So that's at Justin Herman Plaza. Mm-hmm. Could you maybe talk a little bit about the issues there as far as the 9 a.m. rally? Like, what is Code Blue all about? You know, how is this different from the anti-war protests we've had before?
Well, I think Code Blue is, I think a lot of the people that you're going to see on Wednesday is primarily our, is very integrated. So you might see environmental people, people doing healthcare work, housing issues, and also Code Blue is dealing with healthcare particularly. So they are really challenging the notion that there are 45 million people in the United States right now who are uninsured, and also are pretty much bringing some issues about that and raising how corporate interest and privatization of the medical field has pretty much limited people to have access to the basic necessities of just healthcare. So they're really pushing on a universal healthcare strategy or a universal healthcare system in which can pretty much save costs and also minimize some of the bureaucracy and the administrative funding of the project of privatizations. And so they really are charged on looking at the corporate interest within that and looking at how corporations are functioning in a way to pretty much challenge what democracy is or what it can be in the United States in particular.
Yeah, their major message, healthcare not warfare, is also looking at the idea that there's, you know, no.
And also minimize some of the bureaucracy and the administrative funding of the project of privatization.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Silly Bush. Major combat operations have only begun here on Critical Mass Radio Network. That's right. Lock your doors. Put the
of color in this country, and definitely not, you know, improving the lives of Iraqis. So, meanwhile, it's going to, you know, it's going to Bechtel. It's going to, well, not Enron anymore. But
yeah, it's going everywhere. And the critical thing is that these corporations and their interests is not about the people. If it was about the people, these 45 million, including myself, would not be excluded from having health care and also resources in a time when unemployment is at its highest under this current administration. It just brings up a lot of questions of how this healthcare system in which we know it is really really causing a lot of problems and also causing a lot of stress for people who need these types of resources.
It seems to me that really, as far as I know, like none of the labor unions in the U.S. are really fighting for universal health care. They're all fighting for their own health care. You know, when there's a contract up, they'll be on the picket lines for their own jobs and for their own health care. What do you think is the answer? I mean, is taking to the streets really the only way to fight for that? Do you think Kerry's plan will provide universal health care? I mean, what's in the future in the next couple of years for universal health care here in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, you're not going to hear that from either of the major candidates. I mean, there's something that Siafu has been, I mean, and other clearly anti-imperialist folks that were involved right now. I just say that the same capitalist system that Bush is part of, it's the same one that Kerry is part of, and these are not people that want universal health care. It's not helpful.
It's not an interest at all.
So it's gonna. I mean, there are left labor unions that still do exist in this country, and they should be supported in any way possible. But it's gonna be really. I think there are groups like Power in San Francisco. There's people organized to win employment rights, which are working with low and no wage workers, working from the grassroots. And I think groups like this are really gonna be the people that have to pressure the labor unions and in their own way, but also just work from a grassroots level to show that this is something that's necessary.
Mm-hmm. And it's also just like unions in itself, they have been going through a lot of struggle. I mean, corporations and privatization of pretty much everything in this country these days has really like challenged what a union can actually exist these days. So a lot of unions are just basically getting the basic necessities, just fighting for the most minimum task and most minimum resources in which they can align with larger issues. And so I think just the unions in general is just something for us to think about, because it has a legacy that was very powerful, and we need to go back and see if that's even a possibility in the present when we live dealing with corporations and corporations their interests these days.
Okay, so could you maybe go over the details one more time for November 3rd, when and where people can meet, where can they get more information on what's going on?
November 3rd, 9 a.m., Justin Herman Plaza. That is the Code Blue action. Meet there. We'll be marching through downtown near Chinatown and then ending up at the Federal Building, where there's going to be a rally there again. In the evening, 5 p.m., meet at Powell and Markets. And if you want to be part of the anti-imperialist contingent, if you feel affinity with that, then you will definitely see a bunch of folks with banners and signs. And otherwise, the Nyon March will be there. So for information for that?
They should get in contact with Not In Our Name.
Not In Our Name. We definitely have information.
Yeah, and also the Direct Action.
Direct Action to Stop the War would have information on that.
And what should people bring when they come out on Wednesday?
They should bring some fire in their belly.
They better bring just some heat and also just like bring the struggle and also bring stories, bring music, be prepared to sing, be prepared to just have a good time. But they should also just be warm. It might be cold that day.
So bring fire and noisemakers.
Bring fire in the belly,
basically.
Definitely. Noisemakers and drums and all kinds of stuff like that.
Okay, you heard it here first. Thanks so much for coming on the show today. We have to move on. I don't even know how much more stuff we have that we have to fit on the air by 7 p.m., so we should keep going. But this is Enemy Combatant Radio. Thanks to Niall and Greg for coming on the air tonight.
Thank you.
And you guys can feel free to call in from the streets on Wednesday. We're going to be on the air here. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we'll be on the FM airwaves through our friendly pirate radio relays. And so the number here is 415-864-1006, and hopefully we can get some reports on the air Wednesday.
Appreciate it.
So hopefully talk to you then.
All right, thank you.
And we That was Le Tigre off of their new CD, This Island. And actually, it featured Sonny Angulo from Enemy Combatant Radio. And you can see them. Well, I think it's sold out, but you can scalp tickets for to see them on the 19th at the Fillmore. Wait a second.
I don't know which mic I'm on. Okay. How come we can't get on the guest list? Since they sampled Enemy Combatant Radio in that.
Maybe we should just go ahead and give tickets out, and then we should assume that we'll be on the guest list.
All
right, okay, so we're going to do something
I figure
now.
We should at least have 10 pairs or so, right?
All
right,
if you're listening, okay, we're not giving away tickets, but we're promising that we're going to try to give away tickets. We're going
to
try really hard. Our number is 864-1006.
415.
Yeah, so we're going to try really hard to get you into the Le Tigre show because they have Enemy Combatant Radio on track 8 of their new CD. It's called New Kicks. And this is actually...
And they didn't request permission.
They did. I remember.
Oh, they did.
Yeah. Or no, maybe... I remember some sort of communication from them to ECR. But also, this is the single that they just released off of this. And it's funny how all of these artists are coming out with anti-war, anti-Brexit.
Finally.
Right before the election.
It's about time.
Have you seen the Eminem video?
This war's been going on for a while.
Who's seen the Eminem video?
No, I've read about that video too many times on the web.
We need to watch
it,
man. It's amazing. It's really good. It's really good animation. All right, so we're going to play this interview with Peter Camejo that was recorded yesterday. And call us if you want to be on the list of us trying to get you into the Le Tigre show. 864-1006.
Oh, well, it's extremely interesting. We're having one of the most historic campaigns on many levels, but it's not what people think. I think the most amazing thing about this campaign is that the overwhelming majority of the people who will vote for Kerry do not agree with him. And it tells you that the whole system is totally broken, where you have a sentiment that maybe between 40 to 50% of the American people oppose the war in Iraq and the arguments that are given for it, and just absolutely would prefer a totally different policy, and yet they're voting for someone who's always voted for the war, that has supported Bush at every turn, and who says that he will, in fact, do a better job of carrying out what Bush is trying to do in Iraq. So that tells you something has gone wrong where people can't vote for what they're for. I think this is the single most important event taking place. It is showing the two-party dictatorship, the two-party broken system that we have, the most undemocratic electoral system in the world. This is the only one where the person who loses the election can actually get elected.
So you've been meeting a lot of people who are kind of apologetic for voting for Kerry, but they feel like they have no other options.
What we see when I go to meetings and in cities and on campuses, especially where there's young people, you see that there's a resistance in America. It's not huge in numbers, but there are, everywhere you turn, there are people that are saying, I can't accept this. I will not accept it. It reminds me historically of when the Liberty Party was launched in America in 1840 to fight slavery. They said, we are no longer going to look to see which of the two major candidates are least for slavery. We're going to start running candidates who oppose slavery. And that's what the Nader campaign is. It's saying we're not for money ruling over America. We're not for the Patriot Act. We're not for the war. We're for the Kyoto Protocol. We are for the World Court. We are against the Taft-Hartley law. That is, all those fundamental things which 30 to 70% of the American people agree with, which no candidate from the Democrats or Republicans will stand for.
You are bringing these issues to the presidential race, but kind of in the 2000 election, obviously you're not running underneath the Green Party ticket now, but the major third party candidate, there was kind of a idea behind it of increasing the green representation within the electoral population of the United States. What is your and Nader's role as a third party or a third line, more radical approach within this presidential race? What is your goals, so to say?
Well, I'm a Green Party member, and our campaign is doing more to build the Green Party, certainly than anything else at this time. because we are campaigning everywhere saying that we need an alternative force and that the Green Party is the largest of the third parties that opposes the war, opposes the Patriot Act, and certainly in my campaign, I'm introduced everywhere as a representative of the Green Party. This campaign is really in a coalition, an alliance between independents, Greens, and others, with the Green Party being the largest grouping that's inside the NATO campaign. Most Greens in America who are actually active in the presidential race are active supporting Nader Kamau. There are other Greens that don't agree with this, and they're doing their thing, and that's okay, too, and I certainly respect them.
What do you think happened within the Green Party bureaucracy that led to David Cobb being the nominee?
Well, there's two different things that happened. One is Greens have differences, and that's normal. That's understandable. No one can object to that. And the reason the issue has become somewhat intense in the Green Party is that David Cobb lost the primaries and lost at the state conventions, but won the national convention. And therefore, the feeling is that the way our convention was run was not reflective of the actual membership. If you go to greensfornader.net, you will see a report there written by Forrest Hill that shows that David Cobb received 24.6% support among Greens and Ralph Nader had 60%. So the Green Party should have endorsed Nader, and I offered a unity proposal that both Cobb and Nader be endorsed and that we help both and let David Cobb explain his point of view and those Greens that agree with him, because one of the things I believe in is that truth can only be ascertained through the conflict of ideas. There's nothing wrong with people having differences and saying it. And what we needed is as many people out there speaking against this war and against what the Democrats or Republicans are doing than anything else. So I was sort of sorry that the Cobb current in the Green Party, the lesser, what I call the lesser evil current, the ones who believe that you should at times vote Democrat, would not agree to a compromise. So they happen to have a majority. We believe they stacked the convention. We don't know to what extent the Democrats were involved in that. But whatever it is in the past, we'll get it changed. We're going to change the rules in the Green Party so that can never happen again. And what I mean by that is that whoever the Green Party will choose in the future will be whoever the majority in the Green Party want. We will respect that. If they choose David Cobb, a majority, I would respect that. But the feeling is, and the thing that created a lot of divisiveness, is that it was challenged, and it is being challenged, and I think correctly challenged, that the minority took over the party at the convention.
This lesser evil sentiment also, I think very interestingly and maybe even more shockingly, was represented by this petition or declaration that was signed by some 100-something intellectuals, you know, everybody ranging from Chomsky to other prominent people. What do you think this represents in terms of essentially endorsing a vote for Kerry? What do you think that means for radical intellectuals in America and where they are now?
I think it's very important what has happened. I think this is a turning point in the history of the left in America, the progressive movement, whatever term you want to use. We have never seen something like this in the past. Because what it was that the intellectuals of America who have been considered progressives as a group have capitulated and said we must accept the two-party dictatorship that we live under. We must always vote Democrat, because the logic of what they have done doesn't end. I mean, Medea Benjamin is one of the most honest of these people. She has said, we made a mistake in the year 2000. We should not have voted for Nader, where 3 million people did, and another 8 million wanted to. They say, no, we shouldn't. Instead of them becoming infuriated with the Democrats for not allowing free elections, that is, allowing runoffs, proportional representation, instead they capitulate to them and urge everyone to accept it and vote for a person who's pro-war, pro the Patriot Act, against the Kyoto Protocol, who is very proud of the fact that he killed people in Vietnam. I mean, has the progressive forgotten what Vietnam is and what happened in Vietnam? We invaded in violation of all the laws of the world. We killed 2 million people. And that now is given as a reason to vote for somebody for president. To me, those who have stood up against this, and starting with Ralph Nader, are the future of America developing an opposition. Many of these people may change their mind in the future, but in general, when this happens, it's the end of a generation. It's the drawing of the line and the end of a period. It's like when the abolitionists after the Civil War turned against blacks and began denouncing African-American rights, like the Nation led the campaign for abolitionists to declare themselves against African-American rights. It's interesting that it's the Nation that's once again taking the lead in telling people to turn against independent political action and to vote Democrat. And that ended a period. I think what this capitulation shows is the end of liberalism in America as a really progressive alternative, and we have to start looking elsewhere. And I think the Green Party is a good example. People like Matt Gonzalez, Rene Saucedo, Ross Mercurimi, who's running here, the last two are running right now in San Francisco, where 47% of the people voted for Matt Gonzalez. This is a new generation, and this is the generation of people that don't capitulate, that say we have to fight for what we believe in, and we have to vote for what we believe in.
We are also, as you probably know, a radio station in San Francisco, and you ran last year in the governor recall race. So I'd like to get your personal thoughts on Schwarzenegger's policies, and what do you think he meant at the Republican National Convention when he calls Kerry and Edwards said they had girly men economics.
Well, Arnold is a person who sometimes make statements that shows the ignorance and backwardness that exists in America. This really is a homophobic term, because what it is against, you know, it's a machismo thing. And for us not to understand the root of that and what that means and how that word, these kinds of words have been used throughout our history, and for him to be able to say it and the media lets him, gives him a buy on it, tells you that the battle for full rights for women, inequality for gays and lesbians is far from won in America. That's what it shows. And that he can turn this just into a joke and it's accepted and dismissed. This type of ignorance has, for years, been effective, intimidating and discriminating against people, and against women and against gays and lesbians. And I think it's a terrible thing that it just passes and it's allowed to pass. And of course, the Democrats do nothing about it. They make some little passing statement, but they don't take them on and expose for what it is.
And Arnold also has very controversial, in our opinion, policies in terms of immigrants' rights. For example, the not allowing driver's licenses for immigrants. And you're a first generation immigrant from Venezuela, and Bush has this controversial new idea of allowing Latinos to work here on temporary visas. What do you think this represents, and what is the Nader Camejo tickets immigration stance?
Well, Kerry has come out against the driver's license for the undocumented, as Bush, the Republicans, of course, are also against it. We have 11 million people living in the United States without papers, and they're essential to the economy. No one is proposing to remove them from the United States, but they want them to live as a lower class, as a caste system, where they don't have the same legal rights. That's a violation of the UN Charter. What Bush is proposing is really horrendous, because what he is basically saying, contrary to everything else he claims he's for dividing families, having men come here and leave their children behind and their wives behind. They cannot. See, what he's saying is we want Mexicans and we want people from India or China to come here so we can exploit them, but we don't want them to live here. They can come and visit to work and then they leave. This is the concept behind it. Of course, it's a racist concept. The way Mexican immigrants and Chinese immigrants have been treated in American history is completely different from how European immigrants were treated. And right now in San Francisco, Proposition F, we're about to vote, right of immigrants to vote on Board of Education elections, which is a huge step forward, because in American history, when the Irish came here, Germans, Italians, they were all given the right to vote before they were citizens. Because the concept is no taxation without representation. But Mexicans have not been allowed to vote. So we have a situation where both Democrats and Republicans use the immigrant as a scapegoat to blame problems that they have nothing to do with. All immigrants are is like everybody else in the world. They're trying to make a living to feed their families. That's all it is. And America has to have a policy towards this. And the policy can't be to try to maintain a caste system in America where people of Mexican descent, who are
in California, certainly the original people of here, they're actually the indigenous people. The first debate, the recall election, when I was asked on this, I said, well, the European Americans have been here 150 years. I think it's time to give them a driver's license. But the Mexicans, they've been here 20,000 years in this continent. Obviously, they should have a driver's license. I mean, this whole issue is just presented in the totally wrong framework. And what Arnold Schwarzenegger did was go and say, I'm an immigrant. And I think it was 2 days before he went to the Republican convention, he betrayed what he had said publicly, that he would be for the driver's license in California, betrayed and Gilbert Cedillo, our senator, who's been fighting for the driver's license after he promised. I even saw Arnold myself, personally saw him on Fox National Television saying, I'm for the driver's license, I will agree to it. And then he betrayed that and then goes gives a speech about immigrants and how he cares about immigrants. The truth is, what he means is Europeans. When Europeans come here, that's fine, but not a people of other races.
It looks like already, even the election hasn't happened, but it's pretty evident that it's going to be so close, and there are going to be enough votes and controversial ballots, etc., tied up in court, that the election is actually not going to end for a few more months, which is, in my opinion, kind of sad, because I was looking forward to a change in discourse. And eventually, when this discourse changes, how do you see the future of the Green Party fitting into the new political landscape, as you said, after the death of liberalism in America? And what about any options or venues for electoral reform in the United States?
Well, I think that it's not clear what's going to happen, either in the vote or in the aftermath. One thing I do not trust is when the media says it's very close, because the two-party system wants it always to be close, not a tie. They don't want a tie, but they'd like it to be within 1 or 2%. That keeps the two-party system going. That's why big corporations give to both parties. They don't like it if one side wins by a lot. It destabilizes. It makes people want alternatives, hear other views. They want to keep it as though this is America. We have this great stable system called the two-party system. We don't have a two-party system. Of course, that's a myth. We have a one-party system in which the appearance of a debate goes on, but there is no real debate, because all Kerry and Bush are saying is who can do the same policy the best. But the elections are supposed to be about policy. What will happen right after this election is very unclear. And if there are the two machines, the two electoral machines, do have a lot of money at stake of which one happens to win. And their base, their supporters, are really interested in this. When you look at those conventions, everybody who's there as a delegate has a money connection with their party winning or not winning. And this group of people are really, but the corporate world doesn't really care too much. They want stability. And they would dump Bush if they felt enough resistance in America. That's why when the Democrats silenced Nader and stop all demonstrations, the Sierra Club says stop doing anything, and everybody else stops, no peace demonstrations, nothing. What that does, of course, is help re-elect Bush, because now the money says, well, we don't need to have a change then, we're okay, there's no resistance. The money would shift to the Democrats, simply to bring in a new face and to gain more credibility. Kerry's there as an alternative to save the credibility for the policies Bush has started. It's very likely, given the way Kerry has handled himself in the Democrats, is that Bush will be reelected. Very high probability, because even though Bush has been a complete failure, and under his administration, we have never had this happen in 70 years, where you lose jobs. We're about 7 to 9 million jobs behind what is normal in the economy in a cycle. I don't have time to explain why that is, but population grows every year, so it's not just the 1.5 million jobs that have been lost. There's jobs that never got created that normally would have been created. So he's way behind the economy. It's a disaster what he's done is in Iraq. In Iraq, the United States Army doesn't really control the country. It's just they're killing people and trying to occupy certain areas. Most of Iraq is not under their control. And it's obvious that as days go by, the United States can't seem to get control of Iraq, even though it is a country 12 times the size and economically, you know, enormous power, unable to. The resistance of the people in Iraq is absolutely amazing. It's like the way the Vietnamese were able to resist the American occupation. So this, with these two failures, the Democrats should have walked all over Bush. But what they did instead was shore him up by accepting his premises, assuring, all done with words and language that sounds like there's a real ferocious debate going on and people have real differences. And this liberal capitulation really is a capitulation to Bush. And the campaign for Nader not to run is really an extension of the Patriot Act. Patriot Act says we're taking away your rights because we have a problem, and that is that we're extremely unpopular in the world and crazy people are attacking us, so therefore we're going to take away the American people's rights. And what these liberals now say is, well, we have to take away more rights. We have to not allow people to run for office who are for peace, against these policies, are willing to question it, because that's the only way. So what you have is there's a drift to the right happening in America, and I think after this election, we're going to see more of that, but the question is, are we going to see a resistance grow? Are we going to see opposition? I think so. I think it's latent. I think, like, well, I lived through the Vietnam period, so I remember the way it happened. And things would get real quiet during the presidential election. Even in the congressional and Senate elections, it would tend to quiet down. But then afterwards, the opposition to it would grow. And we're totally isolated in the world. You know, today, the United Nations voted 179-4 against the United States on our continued embargo of Cuba. And they do this every single year. The whole world is against what America's doing in the world. And the Democrats and Republicans represent this tiny minority in the world. Their whole policy in Iraq has created the greatest political unification of our species ever in the history of the world, in opposition to what the United States is doing. And certainly that voice and that opinion is going to break through. And this is what we're trying to keep alive during the campaign. But the minute the election's over, I think it will resurface regardless of who wins.
One last question I want to ask, which is kind of close to the hearts of us who do media activism and radio activism. What are your thoughts in terms of FCC consolidation and low-power micro radio? And, for example, about a year and a half ago, San Francisco Liberation Radio was shut down. Just last month, Free Radio Santa Cruz was shut down by FCC agents. What do you think about this subject?
Six corporations now control our media, and they're all run by conservative Republicans. We have basically lost freedom of the press in America. People don't know what this nation was like going back 100 years, 150 years, when every city had 10 newspapers. And when you go back into the 19th century, my God, papers would appear, disappear all the time. All kinds of points of views would be heard and so forth. This is over. The TV and the major daily newspapers are all totally corporate, controlled. Anyone gets out of line, they're removed. Now, that generates the beginning of a resistance. It's taken many forms. The internet is a big opening for freedom of the press. But I think in this area, the work you're doing, the work that all these groups are doing, is creating the beginning of an awareness that what we're hearing in the media is basically a giant lie. It's misinformation. We don't hear any information on the war. What we hear is propaganda. Facts slip through, that's true. And if you read the New York Times, occasionally you pick up little messages and stuff about the reality, but it's all done within the frame of a giant lie. The United States is there to help the people of Iraq and to establish democracy. The United States supported Saddam Hussein for 20 years, gave him poison gas. When he used it, they had secret meetings with his representatives to assure them the United States backed him. George Bush Sr. made public statements congratulating Saddam Hussein for the good work done. So when they come and say, oh, we're there because Saddam Hussein was a terrible dictator, they're talking about themselves. They're talking about what they did. And yet the media totally covers it up for them. Kerry would not say a word against Bush of what the Reagan and Bush did in their time in support of Saddam Hussein, because, of course, the Democrats were doing the same thing and supporting the same policy. So the media is a major, major crisis. And as a new generation in America, these things take a lot of time, take time. As people become aware of this and a current develops that understands it, a resistance will develop in America, and part of it will be expressed through radio and written and websites and other methods in which information and facts will reach people. And therefore, I want to congratulate you for the work you all do and that many others like you are trying to do throughout America.
Thank you, and good luck on the last few days of your campaign.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Enemy Combatant Radio, broadcasting this evening as part of the Critical Mass Radio Network. We just listened to Peter Camejo with an interview recorded from yesterday. Apologies about the poor sound quality, but we will try to do better next time. Of course, we're always hoping that someone will donate us all the fabulous studio gear that we need here at Enemy Combatant Radio, but it hasn't really happened yet. So, we'll see. Anyways, we just had a caller, and I hope that they'll call back. But just to get a little more information on what's happening Monday. But I can go over some headlines from indie media here in the Bay Area. First of all, the hotel worker strike continues in San Francisco, with 4,000 hotel workers locked out by the multi-employer group, which is the management group that operates, I guess, 14 different hotels at least in San Francisco. That is the number of hotels which have been locked out. There will be a solidarity picket Sunday evening at 7 p.m., holiday solidarity picket. It's a flying picket. People will be marching around to as many different hotel picket lines as they can, from like maybe 7 to 9 p.m. or so. That happens every Sunday, so you can also catch it the following Sunday, November 7th, at 7 p.m., and that meets at Powell and Geary Streets at Union Square. Also, Critical Mass was going to ride by some of the hotels this evening, so they may be doing that right now, in fact. And finally, the actions that we already talked about Wednesday morning, November 3rd, they will be probably marching past some of the hotel picket lines on the way from Justin Herman Plaza to the Federal Building. So that would be another way to come out and show some solidarity for the hotel workers. In other news, U.S. District Court Judge William Alsup on Wednesday denied the City of Alameda's request for a preliminary injunction, which would have stopped the mass eviction of 1,200 low-income renters at the Harbor Island Apartments. The judge ruled that the City of Alameda had failed to demonstrate that the remaining tenants in the apartment complex would be homeless if evicted. So now if these tenants do not leave by midnight of November 3rd, they will face a lawsuit against them by the property owner 15 Group, which owns thousands of apartment units in 9 different states. Also, this is all partly related to the Section 8 housing crisis, which is affecting communities across the country. The Department of Housing and Urban Development has cut back a huge amount of funding for Section 8 housing vouchers. And so, for instance, Marin County lost all of its funding for Section 8 housing. And this has caused a number of nonprofit housing providers to basically shut down plans to open up new housing for low-income people, and they're selling off this housing at market prices. Now, of course, Marin is a fairly affluent community. However, for the working people that actually do everything in Marin County, it's increasingly very difficult for them to find a reasonable place to live, so they're certainly going to be affected by this problem with Section 8 housing. We just had a caller, so we might be able to get them on the air. But I think we'll be switching over to Freak Radio Santa Cruz soon. So stay tuned to Critical Mass Radio, www.criticalmassradio.net, the last Friday of every month, coming at you from 6 different web radio stations and maybe more in the future.
The final candidate for student council president is another one of the Metzler clan, sophomore Tammy Metzler. Tammy.
About this stupid election. We all know it doesn't matter who gets elected president of Carver. Do you really think it's going to change anything around here? Make one single person smarter, or happier, or nicer? The only person it does matter to is the one who gets elected. The same pathetic charade happens every year, and everyone makes the same pathetic promises just so they can put it on their transcripts to get into college. So vote for me, because I don't even want to go to college, and I don't care, and as president, I won't do anything. The only promise I will make is that if elected, I will immediately dismantle the student government so that none of us will ever have to sit through one of these stupid assemblies again.
My name is Selma James. I'm with the Global Women's Strike, and you're listening to Enemy Combatant Radio.
No. Rolling?
Okay, wait, no, don't roll yet.
Rolling?